Diane. Great to be with you. On My Mind this week, what Financial Times columnist Ed Luce calls the retreat of Western liberalism.
The idea that 2016, with Brexit and with Trump's election, was a sort of volcanic eruption out of normally dormant range of volcanoes, I felt was very, very wrong, and that we didn't understand the deeper structural backdrop to what has given rise to populism in the West.
I spoke with him before President Trump's comments in Poland.
The West will never, ever be broken. Our values will prevail. Our people will thrive. And our civilization will triumph.
Then,
in a way, the whole rest of the novel is Jane Eyre defining what her space is.
A literary agent, here's a Georgetown University professor on the Diane Rehm Show a few years back, discussing the novel Jane Eyre, and asks him to write a book on Charlotte Bronte. He did, and he joins me to talk about it.
Most of my career, I've been interested in how artists create the things that we find so beautiful and so moving. And how does a human person make something that then lives, as Jane Eyre lives, for, you know, centuries, really?
First, Ed Luce. He's chief U.S. columnist for the Financial Times. His new book is titled The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Ed Luce, what a pleasure to see you.
It's a delight to see you, Diane.
Thank you. Tell me, if you would, how you would describe Western liberalism.
That's a great question. I would, first of all, differentiate it from the American use of the term liberal. I mean Western liberalism in the sense that we would understand from the Enlightenment thinkers, the founding fathers, the John Stuart Mills, as a system of government that goes way beyond majority rule. It's about independence of the courts. It's about a strong civil society, separation of powers in some cases. But it's about strong institutions that can withstand, you know, the change, ever-changing winds of public opinion that are stronger than that. And democracy really comes after liberalism. So we're used to saying liberal democracy. But actually, the liberal bit came first. And I think it's very hard for democracy to take root for long in any society in the world without the liberal institutions that undergird it.
And, of course, those liberal institutions have been at work in the West for quite some time.
They have. I mean, the oldest functioning, sort of continually functioning, one is the U.S. Republic. And if you remember, Benjamin Franklin said, a republic if you can keep it. He didn't say a democracy if you can keep it. It was very much conceived of as a republic. And in Britain, in a different form, it's arguably gone on for longer. You know, the Bill of Rights, which the first American Congress absorbed into, word for word, into the U.S. Constitution, is from 1688. The so-called Glorious Revolution, and the French Revolution, which was very, very strong on the sort of majority rule, arguably tyranny of a majority. It was another sort of branch of if you like, of Western liberal democracy.
So now you've written a book where you talk about the retreat of Western liberalism. Tell us what you see happening.
So, first of all, I did not use the term the collapse of Western liberalism, and there was some debate with my publishers, and I said it has to be retreat, because retreat does imply the possibility of regrouping.
Indeed.
And so that's very important to emphasize. The reason I wrote it was because the idea, I think, that 2016 with Brexit and with Trump's election was a sort of volcanic eruption out of a normally dormant range of volcanoes, I felt was very, very wrong, and that we didn't understand the deeper structural backdrop to what has given rise to populism in the West, particularly in America and Britain, but other parts of the West too.
So you see Trump's election and Brexit as the result rather than the cause of the disruption that's going on in our Western societies.
Absolutely. And I think this has come after a long period of time. I mean, I'll just give you one example. In the year 2000, Gallup, which has been asking this question for a long time, asked Americans, do you define yourself as lower class, middle class, upper class? And 31% of Americans define themselves as lower class in 2000. In 2016, peak Trump campaign, 49% of Americans did. And I think this is as a result of the economic compression that American families have been feeling, a lot of middle America has been feeling, for a very, very long time. I mean, with the exception of the 1990s, when there was a really good blip and wages did rise across the board, basically wages have been stagnant for 40 years in real terms. And usually the way economists define it is by median household income. So if the median household income today is not that much higher than it was in 1978, that actually understates the problem, because in 1978 it was typically a single earner household, and today it's typically a dual earner household. So the woman, more often than the man, he might be more angry about things, but the woman is doing probably several part-time jobs to keep her head above water and the family's heads above water. And so I think that statistic, is sobering though it is also understating this sort of anxiety and frustration so many Americans are feeling.
Well, the other factor there, of course, becomes automation. It becomes artificial intelligence overtaking human beings in terms of doing the real work of the society, and then no possible retraining for the people who've been left aside.
Absolutely. And a really, really good example of this, of how one Western democracy has done that right, is Germany. And I think it's no accident that Germany is has the best antibodies against populism. It's the least susceptible to populism of all the Western democracies. Even France, which has had a pretty good news election, even France has smashed its establishment. But Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, the German establishment, is on course for a fourth consecutive election win in September. And I think how Germany treats its middle class is absolutely key to that. I think it's central to the sense of well-being that Germans feel. And if I could just say one sort of thing that I think is really important to stress, Germans don't confuse having a college degree with being skilled. You can be skilled in Germany without having a college degree. In America and Britain, we don't think like that. And I think it's a really important distinction, because you can have dignity in your job and pride in the skills around you, the social sort of status you get through vocational education, in small manufacturing or other productive jobs. And we don't really provide that ladder in our countries.
But Ed, you say that the emergence of China is the most dramatic event in our economic history. Now, what do you mean by that, and how does that fit into the retreat of Western liberalism?
Well, it's very funny that the year 1978 is the one where most people measure the stagnation of household income in the West. That's the year when China began to loosen up its Maoist system and privatize certain elements of economic activity. And the real Chinese growth miracle begins then, under Deng Xiaoping in the late 70s, and then begins to really take off in the 80s, 90s, and continue in the first decade of this century. China is so huge, it's just so vast, that you know, you can't really compare it to the dramatic rise of South Korea and of Taiwan and Hong Kong in the 70s and 80s, and 60s and 70s, or even of Japan. You know, Japan has 120 million people. China has almost 1.5 billion. The scale of the emergence of an economy this size is having a relentless squeezing effect on the incomes of our middle skilled in the part of the 15% of the world we call the West. The middle of the West is under a relentless wage pressure, both from China and, of course, from technology. And in a way, it's the same thing, because technology allows our companies to produce in China. So technology and globalization are kind of... Globalization would not be possible without technology. And so really increasingly hyper-globalized, hyper-automated economy, global economy, is the bigger context for this story. And that's why we really wanted to emphasize that 2016 was not a blip. And it's not just that the English-speaking democracies have gone crazy for a year or two, that there are deep pressures there that I've experienced for most of my lifetime, or at least witnessed, and I fully expect to continue for the rest of my lifetime. This is a long-term historic trend.
So this is ongoing, this frustration within the middle class in Western economies, with perhaps the exception of Germany. Where do you see that headed in the next few years? Is that unemployment, that frustration, that lack of rising income likely to continue and to intensify?
So I think the trends will intensify, but I don't want to give a counsel of despair at all. I do think there are ways, there are remedies, not complete ones, but there are really good things we can do to give people a sense that their children will be better off, and a realistic sense their children will be better off. One of which I call, for shorthand, I call a Marshall Plan for the middle classes. Really focusing on lifetime, from early learning through adult retraining, evening classes, on the job, a really concerted national priority to focus on the skills of the middle class. And the other I call a New Deal for the gig economy, is that we have a welfare system that's very outdated. It's based on the job you're doing and the social insurance you pay from it, social security you pay from it. And we live in an economy where people are hopping from job to job, or having more than one, lots of full-time jobs. And the system doesn't fit that. It doesn't give them the insurance against a rainy day that their parents were used to. These are really good remedies. I don't think we lack ideas. What I think we lack is a politics that's anywhere close to putting these ideas into, well, or even debating them.
Political system is exactly part of this retreat that you talk about.
It is, and that's the source of my pessimism. So, I mean, I'll take America as an example, but Britain would be an equally good one. One of the reasons Trump got elected was because of all this frustration, and he exploited it brilliantly. And he talked about the forgotten American, and he talked about, you know, putting pride back in the middle class. And he had some specifics, like an infrastructure program. What he's pledged to do in practice, if you look at his budget proposal, is actually dramatically deepen the conditions that led to his election. In other words, to go full speed in the opposite direction
from what he promised.
Absolutely. From what he promised. You know, I don't know whether this is a conscious bait and switch, because it would seem to be really egregious if it was actually sort of premeditated, or whether he just didn't have much clue. He had a feeling for the mood music, and then when he comes to power, he's got these advisors who know what they want to do, and it's more Paul Ryan republicanism than the middle-class republicanism. But whichever it is, it's full speed in the wrong direction if we want to address that sort of the economic anxieties of the middle class.
You know, you talk about retraining as part of a way out or a way forward. And yet, since the Clintons were in power, I've heard Robert Reich speak about retraining over and over and over again. And yet, it seems to me that there is no way really to take a steel worker or an automobile worker who's been in that job for, say, 30, 40 years, finds him or herself out because of automation. What does that future hold? It would seem it holds a period of simple waiting for the next generation as opposed to, honest to God, retraining of those people who are on their way out.
It's a really good question, and it's a very difficult one because people are stubborn, and let's be honest, you know, frank about it, men, particularly middle-aged and older men, are very resistant to more feminized jobs, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about more feminized jobs.
What do you mean, more feminized jobs?
So not the factory floor, not the sort of iron and steel kind of job that Trump's been, I think, rather fantastically promising he'll bring back. And an example of this, you know, he is paying way more attention to male nostalgia for old shop floor jobs than he is to current female dilemmas in the labor force, which are also male. So a good example of this is there are 77,000 steel jobs in America left, and there are 84,000 coal jobs. Now, the steel jobs, a lot of them are very good, really good jobs, highly skilled, but they're way fewer than they used to be. And if steel's going to get more competitive, there'll be even fewer. There'll be even more automated, more PhDs on this. Coal, goodness knows why you'd want to keep 84,000 people underground, getting black lung disease. But anyway, these are 84,000, 77,000. There are 15.5 million jobs in the retail sector. And it's being Amazonized. You know, again, Amazon's creating some really good jobs, but they're not on the same scale as the jobs that are destroyed. Now, a lot of these are part-time, and a lot of these are women, and they're less vocal, they're less political, and Trump's not paying the slightest bit of attention, and we have lost, since Trump was elected on November the 8th, almost 100,000 retail jobs alone in the last 7 months. Not a word from the White House.
Amazon moving in, taking over that kind of retail, reaching peaks we never imagined.
And of course,
even groceries now,
we're talking about
Whole Foods, deliveries, automated. The people who work in the store arranging the groceries, arranging tomatoes, celery, broccoli, how are they going to be affected, I wonder?
I mean, the more skilled of them or the more versatile and entrepreneurial of them will get higher power jobs as logistics managers or data processors in working for Amazon or whoever, but they will be fewer than those who've lost their jobs. So we need to sort of equip those who will lose their jobs for higher skilled jobs, and it'll create its own demand. We don't know what sector it'll be in.
Let's talk about the tax system, because that's another area you believe has to be reformed in order to at least begin to normalize the system.
Yes. At the moment, if you look at the fiscal setup in America, it's a very, very complicated tax system, and it's increasingly therefore prey to those with the resources to lobby, to change small print, to carve out exceptions and depreciation allowances and so forth. So it's really very much the product of 30 years now of vested, since the Reagan tax reform of 86, which simplified, 30 years now of vested interests, and most of the benefits through tax subsidy, which we don't think of as spending, but it has exactly the same effect as spending on the bottom line. Most of the benefits go to wealthier Americans who are very well positioned to lobby for, to keep those benefits. So, you know, the breaks, the tax breaks for higher education, the tax breaks for your mortgage. The larger your McMansion, the bigger the taxpayer's subsidy. And if you start to add all this up, this is five Marshall Plans for the middle class. This is huge money we're talking about. So the resources are there. And the idea is there. That is not the problem. It's getting to the position where you've overcome, you've had some kind of big bang economic reform with really courageous politics that can liberate these resources to spend on tomorrow rather than, you know, what most of the budget goes on, which is essentially yesterday. It's you know, interest payments on the debt. It's Medicare. It's benefits for people who actually don't need them.
So what you are saying is that economic growth, steady economic growth, is the key to maintaining a liberal democracy.
Yes. I think it's necessary, but it's not necessarily sufficient. Without economic growth, we can call the whole game off after a while. I mean, we cannot survive, you know, a whole generation of this, another whole generation of this. With economic growth, you still need more. You still need the values that we have, you know, of liberal democracy. So I'm not saying it's all just economics, but we've got to have the economics. We've got to have people feeling they've got a stake, that they actually, that we, and it's more than just that they've got an economic stake, that they're wanted, that there is demand for them, that they are need. You know, when you lose a job as an electrician, you're not just losing an income, you're losing something you call yourself. That's your identity in a bigger sense.
So there are an awful lot of folks who believe that Donald Trump, even Brexit, are just a blip. And once the next election comes along and somebody with different ideas moves in, that's going to fix everything. You don't see it that way.
No, well, you know, I can actually imagine it easier with Trump because Trump's got a 4-year term. Brexit looks like it's for keeps, and there's a big price tag attached to Britain just cutting itself off from the largest single market in the world. That's hard to, unless the British are offered a second referendum, which I think they'd say the right thing.
Which they could be.
It's possible.
Which they could be.
That's true. But I'd put that more in the category of, oh, Trump being impeached, a British second referendum. These are sort of Hail Mary scenarios that we could imagine, but we can't bet on them. So I think we can revert. I think these are long-term trends.
Long-term. When you say long-term, what does that mean?
So I think this pressure on the middle class is a long-term thing. I think what we were talking about in terms of China and in terms of technology, these aren't going to go away, but I think we can learn how to cope with these much better and actually even profit from them. Because, you know, in a funny way, if you stand back, we're living in an age of abundance, extraordinary abundance. And we're also living in an age of great humanitarian progress where hundreds of millions of people around the world, elsewhere, but because of the system we set up of Pax Americana, are being lifted out of poverty. That women are suddenly getting autonomy on a scale that history has never delivered before. And their children are becoming literate. And so on a larger sort of, if you look at it as the world as a whole, this is actually quite a good news moment.
And yet, at the same time, you see the Trump administration attempting to roll back some of the freedoms women have enjoyed. For example, restricting monies for Planned Parenthood, which 97% of which provides health care for women, and yet they're being closed down. That doesn't sound to me like an example of greater freedom for women.
No, it certainly isn't. I mean, it's the gender dimension to this administration on many levels is just quite extraordinary, and by that I mean the male dimension. The Ivanka Trump stuff about, you know, maternity leave seems to be just words. Just PR.
Just words.
Just words. And I'm afraid that, you know, if Trump stays a full term, or indeed two full terms, the undoing of things in America is going to take a long time to redo. If indeed we then vote for an anti-Trump and you know, get back to a more balanced and less irascible politics. But I fear the damage that Trump could do. And, you know, we haven't mentioned, of course, global geopolitics and the psychology of Trump in the meantime and how he responds when there's a real crisis. Goodness knows.
And on that note, I want to ask you about North Korea. And the president is in the midst of a foreign trip. He will meet with Vladimir Putin. He will also meet with the leader of China. The question becomes, how far is North Korea willing to go to express its own muscle, its own power? Is it ready to engage with the United States in more than a war of words?
So, I mean, this could be the most important question of our time, potentially, because, as you know, the North Koreans conducted an ICBM test, intercontinental ballistic missile test, a few days ago, and it went up to an altitude of 2,500 kilometers and a distance of 950. Now, if they lowered the altitude, the distance could reach Alaska. So we're getting into the stage where the North Korean nuclear-tipped missiles could actually be within range of the United States mainland. And that's happened very quickly, really. In 2-3 years, the speed with which this program has developed is extraordinary. So your question is, will North Korea do anything to slow this down? Can we persuade it to slow it down or even dismantle it? The history doesn't show that. I mean, I think when you've got a dictator age 31 who's got no legitimacy, Kim Jong-un, and whose only insurance policy against being thrown out of office or worse is his nuclear program, then I expect he's going to just keep doubling down on it.
Is it a lack of respect for the United States that has progressively come into being, or is it a flexing of muscles on this young leader's part? I find myself wondering about both sides of that issue.
His psychology is, you know, a subject of endless fascination and debate. All one can say is this is a very thuggish one-man regime that is held together by fear internally and keeps together externally through the fear he's now able to, you know, engender in South Korea and Japan and increasingly in the United States. He bumps off uncles, you know, in airports in Malaysia. He has sort of Al Capone methods of keeping power. And, you know, Al Capone in a corner with a nuclear weapon is a very, very dangerous psychology. So the Chinese, who, you know, are the only country that really has sway in Pyongyang, they said to Trump, Xi Jinping in Mar-a-Lago in April said to Trump, sure, I'll help you. And Trump said, okay, I'll call off the protectionist rhetoric if you help me. But China hasn't really done anything that it wasn't doing before. It's sort of mild slaps on the wrist, but there's still plenty of trade going on between China and North Korea. I don't think China wants to see a unified South Korea under an American security guarantee. It does not want GIs up on its border. And so China isn't really going to shift its position. It's a useful buffer state. Unless, I guess, Kim Jong-un goes really crazy and starts actually maybe almost using these things, then China might change its mind. But I don't think, I don't think Trump's art of the deal is any match for Sun Tzu's The Art of War.
That's what worries me, not only in regard to North Korea, but other countries around the world. Is there an increasing loss of respect for the United States as a world power?
There is under Trump. I mean, under Obama, it got quite high. I think there were frustrations in certain parts of the world, like the Gulf. But generally speaking, America's standing went right up during most of Obama's period in office. Under Trump, it's just plummeted. It's gone through the floor in most countries. I think there are a couple of exceptions, like the Philippines, which has its own very thuggish president, Rodrigo Duterte. And I guess the question is that a permanent hit to America's standing and its soft power and its admiration as a model, or is it just Trump specific? And I think a lot of the answer to that depends on what Trump does when that hypothetical crisis hits, which it does, or more than one. How does he respond when he's really under pressure and the stakes are really high? And I don't know what that would be. It could be North Korea. It could be something in the South China Sea. It could be Putin, nibbling off a bit of the Baltics. How does Trump respond? And I think America could resume the American-led global order if we don't have a catastrophe under Trump. But if we have a catastrophe, of course, a catastrophe is a catastrophe. Then all bets are off.
Edward Luce, his new book, which has been highly praised, is titled The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Diane.
Now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Now, Georgetown University Professor John Fordrescher. John Fordrescher, it's good to have you with us again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You have written a brand new book titled The Secret History of Jane Eyre, How Charlotte Bronte Wrote Her Masterpiece. Tell us how you got started on this.
Well, I think it's a sweet story. I was with you and Maureen Dowd and Siri James talking about Jane Eyre. And then that was recorded and available as a podcast. And a couple of years later, a literary agent wrote me an email and said, this is one of my favorite books. Would you be interested in working on a book about how, that's the operative word, Charlotte Bronte came to write a book I like so much? And I said to her, this sounds like a lot of fun. So we wrote up a kind of book proposal, and in September of 2014, W.W. Norton said, okay, let's do it.
It's fascinating to me that more than 2 years after we recorded that reader's review on the Diane Rehm show, that the editor actually came to you.
Yeah, isn't it?
Wasn't that intriguing?
Yes, absolutely.
And tell me what intrigued you so much about the how.
I think most of my career I've been interested in how artists create the things that we find so beautiful and so moving. Where does writing and music and so on come from? And how does a human person make something that then lives as Jane Eyre lives for, you know, centuries, really, and still engages the feelings and the thoughts of readers? So I'm interested in how that happens.
And in the case of Charlotte Bronte, what did you discover?
Well, there are, in a sense, this title, Secret History, points to a series of experiences in her life which she didn't want to make public, but which were incredibly important and driving experiences for her. In the summer of 1846, her father, who was an Anglican priest, had such bad cataracts of the eyes that he might be going blind. And there was nobody else in the family to support the Brontes. And so there was this family crisis, which she didn't want to make much of. Then she had been what we might consider a failed author, in the sense that she and her sisters had published a book of poems and two copies had sold. And then she'd written a novel called The Professor, and no publisher would print it. So this was a second sort of secret crisis for her. But the real driving, the deep motivation for writing the novel, at least the novel we know, is that in 1842 to 43, she had gone to Brussels to learn French and had fallen in love with her French teacher, an older married man. And when she returned to Haworth and to England, she wrote him a series of letters. Four of them survive, which are extraordinary documents because they are so frank about her passionate love for him. And he didn't know what to do. His answers don't survive, but conjectures would have it that he wrote polite responses, thank you very much, it's good to hear from you, and then he stopped replying. And 9 months later, she started to write Jane Eyre. And so Jane Eyre is clearly her last letter to Constantine Heger, expressing the love that, and frustrated love and passion that she feels for him when he will no longer answer her. So everything about her feelings gets poured into the novel. That's, I think, one of the principal reasons why we care.
She wrote Jane Eyre under a pseudonym. Why?
It's a very, very important issue. The story has circulated since her own day that her sister Emily was so troubled, angry, when Charlotte found Emily's poems and said, let's publish them and maybe we can make a little money, that Charlotte accepted to pledge to be pseudonymous. Currer Bell, the three sisters all took pseudonyms with ambiguous first names. But the real reason that Charlotte Bronte did not want the world to know is because so much of this book was so profoundly private to her. And so when the book appeared, for over a year there was lots of debate about, was the author a woman or a man? Lots of the early reviews were raising the conjecture, you know, does this sound like a woman's writing, or is it more a man's writing? And of course, all the prejudices of the era are at play. Finally, there's a very funny story that was very nicely included in a BBC film that came out last year. An unscrupulous publisher named Newbie. So Jane Eyre's published. It's a huge success. Nobody knows who the author is. Newbie started to spread rumors, oh, I've got more books by Currer Bell, and I'll publish them. So both Charlotte and her sister Anne took an all-night train and went to the offices of Smith Elder, the publishers. And they walked in on a Saturday afternoon, and they said, hi, I'm Currer Bell. And, of course, this was an all-male office. They were astonished that these two diminutive women from Yorkshire were, in fact, and particularly Charlotte, was Currer Bell. But she kept maintaining the pseudonym. Even with the publication of her final novel, Villette, she kept up the pseudonym.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Even though really by that time, The literary world all knew that it was Charlotte Bronte.
Here's what I want to know, considering all the conjecture, considering all of the ideas about who had written this passionate, romantic novel. What were the reviews like?
At first, they were very laudatory. When the book appeared in September of 1847, they were very laudatory.
1847.
But then the question of whether it was a man or a woman morphed into the question of whether the voice in the novel was appropriate as a woman's voice. And if I could say, I think that the reason that reviewers began to find fault with her as not being a Christian, this was one of the reviews, as being coarse, that was a word that was used, unfeminine. Behind these attacks is, it seems to me, the crucial thing about this book. Her earlier writings had all been voiced by male narrators. With the beginning of Jane Eyre, she has a female narrator. And I think it's clearly because of the frustration and unhappiness in her own life that she's decided that she's going to speak out in her own voice. And the model for that voice are a series of letters that she'd written to a dear friend from school, Ellen Nussey, starting back in 1831. And the letters are marvelous. They're very authentic and honest, and they speak about her feelings and her judgments and so on. So she learned from that long-term writing experience how to voice herself. And as you know, every reader knows, Jane Eyre is extremely frank in forming her own judgments about everybody she meets. And the crucial ultimate judgment is that when she learns that Mr. Rochester is married and she is passionately in love with him, it's very clear that that Jane Eyre is a for all of her slight stature and not looking very good to other people, she has a powerful sex drive. But when she's confronted with the question of going away to live with him in a bigamous relationship in the south of France, she realizes that she's going to lose her independence. And so she determines that even though everything about her feelings and maybe her body long to accept his insistence that she go south with him, she refuses and runs off into an utterly unknown future. And it's that moments like that that are so stunning to readers, it seems to me, where Jane's judgment, personal assessment of what's right and what's wrong, trumps everything else.
There was also the criticism that how in the world could her voice have carried when she reaches out or he reaches out to her after he has gone blind and he longs for her and somehow that voice carries.
Yes, yeah. Early on in the middle of their first love relationship when they're at Thornfield, he uses this phrase called a cord of communion between them. And there's various moments when he can anticipate what she's thinking and so on. So Bronte lays the framework for the idea that they're so close that they sort of know what the other person is thinking and doing. And then there is, yes, this climactic moment when she's about to accept the pressing invitation of St. John Rivers to go off and be a missionary's wife, and she hears his cry.
Extraordinary.
It is, it is.
You know, it really is rather wonderful that Charlotte Bronte could write from her imagination about this kind of passionate love, this passionate romance, even though her love for Heger was never reciprocated and indeed was rejected, yet she writes with such passion.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. There's a crucial letter that she wrote to G.E. Lewes, who was to be the partner of Marianne Evans, George Eliot, when he was preparing a review in December of 1847. And it's the most important document we have about Bronte's consciousness as an artist of how she was working. He had warned her not to be too melodramatic. And she replied, he's preparing the review and he says, I want to warn you about these things. He's a very young writer himself. And she says, when I set out, I wanted to write a book that was true, right? Grave, she says, and soft. And then she goes on to say, but imagination has its own claims. And she uses the feminine gender, and she wants to have her voice as well. And, you know, if you read Jane Eyre with the awareness that there's a kind of double consciousness constantly going on in the book, where on the one hand she's writing about Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester, and on the other she's writing about Charlotte Bronte and Heger.
Indeed.
You're sort of aware of this double sort of consciousness. I was struck the other day, there's a moment, you know, the very, very famous moment when Jane says to Rochester, our spirits are equal. You know, if we didn't have to worry about our bodies and our worldly conditions, you and I are equals. And every modern reader loves that. The page before that, Bronte is saying to the reader, I loved Rochester so much because he expanded my mind, because his own perspectives were so rich. Well, that's not terribly true of Rochester, but it's very true of Heger. Because when she went to Brussels and worked with him, for the first time in her life, she was working with an extraordinary European intellectual. Not only that, but a man who was reading her writing, commenting on her writing, praising it, and then telling her to write better. So this relationship for her as a young woman had been unique. And pages like that, when Jane Eyre says, our spirits are equal, well, she's voicing Charlotte Bronte's feeling that she and Heger are, in a sense, equals.
So it stayed in her heart all those years, those feelings for him, unrequited or otherwise. Tell me, you started this conversation talking about her father's near blindness. I gather from cataracts, what happened with her father?
It's very, very important, really. She took him to Manchester in August of 1846, and the operation was successful. There was a specialist in Manchester at the time. Her father was an extraordinarily strong sort of person and endured the pain of the operation. And then he had to remain in a darkened room for 3 weeks, very unpleasant rooms in Manchester. And the day that he started his recuperation, she picked up her pen and, I think, began to write the first lines of Jane Eyre.
Isn't that fascinating? The very existence of the Bronte family depended on her father's eyesight. As you said, he was an Anglican priest. If he had lost his eyesight, he would have lost their home. He would have lost his professional life. After he began to regain his sight, was the family then stable?
It was. And here it's useful to mention his curate, a guy named Nichols, a man from Northern Ireland. And Nichols did a lot of the work of being a parish priest as Patrick Bronte recovered his eyesight. He wasn't preaching, I think, until November of that same year. And subsequently, Charlotte had no time for Nichols when he first arrived. But subsequently, He fell in love with her almost immediately, and subsequently he professed his love for her, and they married in 1854, I believe.
So what about her sisters and her brother, Bradwell?
What about, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. The successful publication of Jane Eyre was followed by the death first of her brother Branwell, then 2 months later her sister Emily, and then 4 or 5 months later her sister Anne.
How did they die?
Devastating. I think in every case it was tuberculosis. And I believe that her older sisters, who died, you know, having gone to this terrible school for little girls, the Cowan Bridge School, they probably died of tuberculosis too. So it was simply in the family. In the case of Branwell, of course, his life of dissipation hadn't helped. So that led in part to his death. And in the case of Emily, who is such an extraordinary character, as she began to sicken, she refused all medical attention until, I think, the day before she died. Very, very strange, powerful personality. Went her own way.
And how long did her father survive?
It was till well after the deaths of all of his family, yeah.
And how long did the marriage between Charlotte and
Nichols is such a sad story. I'm not going to get the dates, I think, clear on exactly when they married. I think they married in 54. At first, her father was vehemently opposed to the marriage. As one writer said, he didn't want his famous daughter to marry an unimportant curate. But she was touched by Nichols' passionate love for her. They went on what was a very happy honeymoon to Ireland, where she learned how highly esteemed he was. He took her to the West, where he showed her dramatic scenes of the Atlantic coast, which she loved. They came back, and he resumed his clerical duties. They both lived in the family home. And then she began to experience morning sickness.
Oh, my.
And her father said after her death, "I told her she could never survive marriage." The morning sickness got worse and worse. And there's a letter where she says, "I vomit and I vomit until I vomit blood." She lost weight.
She pregnant?
She was pregnant. And after about 3 weeks, she and the child she was bearing died.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
What a story.
Tragic, tragic story. And she had suddenly been very happy being the curate's wife. There's letters where she talks about how she's busy all day helping him out, and this really pleases her. And she calls him my boy. So that it was a period of great happiness for her, then tragically cut short. Almost certainly, her slight body just couldn't carry the demands of childbearing.
John Ford Drescher, what a story you have told in your new book, The Secret History of Jane Eyre, How Charlotte Bronte Wrote Her Masterpiece. Congratulations to you. I'm glad the Diane Rehm Show had a little part in it.
It had a major part. Thank you for talking with me today.
And thank you. Finally, from the archives this week, as we mentioned earlier, it was a reader's review of Jane Eyre that caught the attention of a literary agent and led to the publication of a new book on Charlotte Bronte. Here are the two other guests from the show that day, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd and author Siri James. What's the appeal of Mr. Rochester, Maureen?
You know, every woman loves a man who is obsessed with them. And even when you get it for such a short period of time. And I think that Jane is getting it for her whole life. But these guys would know better than I. But I've read that Mr. Rochester perhaps was based a little bit on Charlotte herself.
Oh, he was based on Monsieur Heger?
Heger, but also the fact that Charlotte had some of these qualities. She was afraid that she was ugly, and she could be a little malicious about the students that she was the governess of, calling them fat-headed oafs and dolts.
Well, also, he was based on a youthful creation of hers that she wrote about in all of her juvenilia called The Duke of Zamorna. She had all these exciting, passionate qualities in this character. And then she fell in love with her Belgian professor, who was also married and unattainable and small, dark, irascible, and cigar-smoking. All of these qualities she blended together in creating Mr. Rochester.
And then elevated him a bit. He's a lot nicer than any of that.
Yeah, I should say.
I can tell you why we love Rochester.
Why?
He's strong and masculine, yet tender, and turns out to be incredibly sympathetic because he's haunted by this terrible inner wound, and he needs someone like Jane to save him. And his infatuation with Jane is really appealing. He covets her thoughts and yearns to penetrate her mind to find out what she thinks of him. And he is drippingly romantic. He calls her across the moors. But, you know, in 19th century, men were taught to believe that women were fallible, weak creatures who needed smelling salts. And here was Rochester, who fell for plain Jane, intellectual, faithful, and loving. It gives hope to the rest of us.
Siri James.
That's our show for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Next week, we're going to have the actor and director of The Originalist, the play about Antonin Scalia. I'd love to hear your comments about it. You can email them to drpodcast@wamu.org or leave us a voicemail with your reactions. That number is 202-854-8851. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.